Hello, and welcome to the African American Hour. I'm Rosemary Onkwe, bringing you readings from the following publications: CNN, The Washington Post, The Voice, Blavity, Ebony, The Root, The Griot, and News One. Today we'll begin with an article from CNN Health titled, "Certain Arm Positions Commonly Used for Blood Pressure Checks May Lead to Inaccurate Results. Here's the Right Way to Do It," by Jacqueline Howard, October 8, 2024. A new study found that having your arm in the wrong position during blood pressure checks, either at home or the doctor's office, can result in readings markedly higher when your arm is in the recommended position, appropriately supported on a table with the middle of the cuff positioned at heart level. This suggests that not consistently having your arm positioned and supported appropriately during a blood pressure reading might result in a misdiagnosis of high blood pressure, while some experts worry could lead to unnecessary treatment. The study, published Monday in the journal JAMA, J-A-M-A, Internal Medicine, found that having your arm resting in the lap during a blood pressure reading can lead to an overestimated systolic blood pressure measurement by 3.9 mmHg, an overestimated diastolic reading by 4 mmHg, and having your arm hang by your side can lead to an overestimated systolic reading by 6.5 mmHg, and an overestimated diastolic reading by 4.4 mmHg. Blood pressure is measured in units of millimeters of mercury, or mmHg, which consists of two numbers, the upper, or systolic reading, and the lower, or diastolic reading. A person is considered as having high blood pressure or hypertension if they have a consistent readings of 130 over 80 or higher. Healthcare providers need to be reminded about the importance of taking the time to do these steps properly, said the study's senior author, Dr. Tammy Brady, who serves as vice chair for clinical research in the Department of Pediatrics at the Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine and medical director of the Pediatric Hypertension Program at Johns Hopkins Children's Center. "I just hope that it raises awareness regarding how important things like arm position are to blood pressure measurement accuracy," Brady said about the study. "I also hope this study educates patients, empowering them to advocate for proper measurement when they're in a clinic setting," she said. "But also because so many patients rely on home blood pressure measurements for hypertension diagnosis, evaluation, and treatment, I hope this educates them on how to properly position their arms, because our findings absolutely extend to measurements in the home." The researchers from Johns Hopkins University recruited 133 adults from Baltimore, Maryland, between August 2022 and June 2023 to participate in the study. The adults, ages 18 to 80, were randomly assigned to have their blood pressure measured while their arms were positioned in three different ways: supported on a desk, as is the recommended standard practice, supported on their lap, or hanging by their side, unsupported. Each study participant underwent a total of 12 blood pressure measurements with their arms in each of those various positions. Among the participants, when their arms were supported on a desk as recommended by the standard clinical guidelines, the average of their blood pressure reading was 126 over 74, the researchers found. But when the participants' arms were resting in their laps during their readings, the average blood pressure reading was 130 over 78, and when their arms were hanging by their sides, the average of their readings was 133 over 78. I did not expect there to be that much of a difference when the arms were placed in the two alternative positions. We tested those positions because those are the positions that most people have their blood pressure measured according to data and personal observation, Brady said. We thought there'd be a difference, but I was surprised by how much of a difference there was. The researchers wrote that there are several psychological reasons why blood pressure measurements could be erroneously higher when the arm is not adequately positioned or supported. A greater vertical distance between the heart and where the cuff is placed can increase hydrostatic pressure in the arteries or the pressure of the blood against the wall due to gravity's pull, leading to an overestimation of blood pressure. And an unsupported arm can lead to the muscles contracting, which may cause an increase in blood pressure. How to check blood pressure accurately? The new study findings are consistent with some separate previous research that has shown unsupported arm positions or the arm being positioned below the heart level can overestimate a blood pressure reading. We know that arm position affects the blood pressure reading. What this study does is gives us a more precise measure of just how much this has an impact, Dr. Nicola Davis, NICHOLA, Vice President and Chief Population Health Officer at NYC Health and Hospitals, who was not involved in the study, said in an email. This is seen in participants with all levels of blood pressure, but more pronounced in participants with elevated blood pressure. These are important findings because we diagnose and treat hypertension based on blood pressure readings, and these readings need to be accurate, Davis said in the email. The researchers wrote in the study that the latest clinical practice guidelines emphasize several key steps for accurate measurement, including 1. Wear the appropriate cuff size. 2. Have your back supported. 3. Keep feet flat on the floor with legs uncrossed. 4. Have the appropriate arm position. The cuff should be positioned at heart level with the arm supported on a desk or table. Wearing the appropriate cuff size is key because an improperly sized blood cuff can distort blood pressure readings taken by automated blood pressure devices. One study published last year in the journal JAMA Internal Medicine found that using standard regular size blood pressure cuffs resulted in striking inaccurate readings if a patient required differently sized ones, particularly for patients who fit larger cuffs. There are some steps people should take before they have their blood pressure checked, said Gail Adler, A-D-L-E-R, a cardiovascular endocrinologist and co-specialist in the hypertension clinic at Brigham and Women's Hospital, who was not involved in the new study. In the 30 minutes before you take your blood pressure, you want no smoking and no major arguments. Don't be psychologically stressed, Adler said. Then, what you want to do is you want to sit in the chair, get in the right position, and for 5 minutes you relax. You don't talk, you rest your arm comfortably, you sit upright with your back straight, you keep your legs uncrossed and your feet flat on the floor. Make sure you don't have to pee, because if you have to pee or urinate, that's going to raise your blood pressure, she said. And you're not supposed to talk when you take your blood pressure, and the cuff should be against your arm, so you don't want to put it over clothes. Because people often feel more calm and comfortable at home, what we're finding now is studies suggest that blood pressures measured at home are a better indicator of your usual blood pressure than blood pressures measured in the office, Adler said. Blood pressure measurements are often suboptimally performed in clinical practice, which can lead to errors that subsequently and inappropriately alter doctors' decisions around managing a patient's blood pressure in about 20% to 45% of cases, according to the American Medical Association. Anecdotally, I think all of us on the study team have started to pay more attention to how our blood pressures are being measured. I've certainly paid attention to how my kids' blood pressures are being measured, Brady said. We shouldn't make hasty judgments. Having high blood pressure raises the risk of heart disease and stroke, which are leading causes of death in the United States. It's estimated that nearly half of adults in the United States have high blood pressure, but only about 1 in 4 adults with high blood pressure has their blood pressure under control, according to the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. I don't think that we are aggressive enough with the treatment of hypertension in America, Dr. Dave Montgomery, a cardiologist at Piedmont Healthcare in Atlanta, who was not involved in the study, said in an email. Hypertension is one of the commonest risk factors for cardiovascular disease and among the easiest to treat and control. Still, hypertension is the culprit or major contributor to a large proportion of cardiovascular morbidity and mortality, he said. We, too, often miss the mark. Regarding the new study, he added that he doesn't see a blood pressure reading that may be off by 4 to 5 mmHg due to arm position, leading to overdiagnosis or overtreatment in the form of new prescription or close modification. If someone has normal blood pressure, 4 mmHg won't change that, but in someone with a diagnosis of hypertension, 5 to 10 points may signal that we don't quite have the control we seek, Montgomery said. He added that blood pressure can change minute by minute due to physical factors and someone's psycho-emotional states. This means that in general, we shouldn't make hasty judgments about one blood pressure reading, but consistently high blood pressure should be treated aggressively, he said. This is how we lower the burden of heart disease. This article was titled, Certain Arm Positions Commonly Used for Blood Pressure Checks May Lead to Inaccurate Results. Here's the Right Way to Do It, by Jacqueline Howard, CNN, October 8, 2024. Next, an article from the Washington Post, titled, Historic Number of Older Americans Are Now Living by Themselves. Longer Lifespans, Rising Rates of Divorce, Widowhood, and Childlessness, and Smaller, Far-Flung Families Are Fueling a Gray Revolution in Older Adults' Living Arrangements. It Can Have Profound Consequences for Their Health. Written by Judith Graham, September 14, 2024. Gary Norington, Norington, 78, never wanted to be on her own as she grew old. But her first marriage ended in divorce, and her second husband died more than 30 years ago. When a 5-year relationship came to a close in 2006, she found herself alone, a situation that has lasted since. I miss having a companion who I can talk to and ask, how was your day? Or, what do you think of what's going on in the world? Said Norington, who lives in an apartment building for seniors on the south side of Chicago. Although she has a loving daughter in the city, I don't want to be a burden to her, she said. Norington is part of a large but often overlooked group, the more than 16 million Americans living alone while growing old, the largest number ever. Surprisingly, little is known about their experiences. This slice of older population has significant health issues. Nearly 4 in 10 seniors living alone have vision or hearing loss, difficulty caring for themselves, and living independently, problems with cognition or other disabilities, according to a KFF analysis of 2022 census data. If help at home isn't available when needed, an altogether too common problem, being alone can magnify these difficulties and contribute to worsening health. Studies have found that seniors on their own are at higher risk of becoming isolated, depressed, and inactive, having accidents, and neglecting their health. As a result, they tend to be hospitalized more often and suffer earlier than expected deaths. Getting to health care services can be a problem, especially if older adults living alone don't drive or live in rural areas. Too often, experts observe health care providers don't ask about older adults' living situations and are unaware of the challenges they face. During the past 6 months, I've spoken to dozens of older adults who live alone either by choice or circumstance, most commonly a spouse's death. Some have adult children or other close relatives who are involved in their lives. Many do not. In lengthy, often intimate conversations, these seniors express several common concerns. How did I end up alone at this time of life? Am I okay with that? Who can I call for help? Who can make decisions on my behalf if I'm unable to? How long will I be able to take care of myself? And what will happen when I can't? This gray revolution in America's living arrangements is fueled by longer lifespans, rising rates of divorce and childlessness, smaller families, the geographic dispersion of family members, an emphasis on aging in place, and a preference for what Eric Kleinberg, Kleinberg, a professor of sociology at New York University, calls intimacy at a distance, being close to family, but not too close. The most reliable up-to-date data about older adults who live alone comes from the U.S. Census Bureau. According to its 2023 current population survey, about 28% of people 65 and older live by themselves, including slightly fewer than 6 million men and slightly more than 10 million women. The figure doesn't include seniors living in institutions, primarily assisted living and nursing homes. By contrast, only 1 in 10 older Americans lived on their own in 1950. This is, first and foremost, an older women's issue because women outlive men and because they're less likely to remarry after being widowed or divorcing. 27% of women ages 65 to 74 live alone, compared with 21% of men. After age 75, an astonishing 43% of women live alone, compared with 24% for men. The vast majority, 80%, of people who live alone after age 65 are divorced or widowed, twice the rate of the general population, according to a KFF analysis of 2022 census data. More than 20% have incomes below $13,590, the federal poverty line in 2022, while 27% make between that and $27,180, twice the poverty level. The importance of attitude. Of course, their experiences vary widely. How older adults living alone are faring depends on their financial status, their housing, their network of friends and family members, and resources in the communities where they live. Attitudes can make a difference. Many older adults relish being independent, while others feel abandoned. It's common for loneliness to come and go, even among people who have caring friends and family members. I like being alone better than I like being in relationships, said Janice Chavez, Chavez, of Denver, who is in her 70s. I don't have to ask anybody for anything. If I want to sleep late, I sleep late. If I want to stay up and watch TV, I can. I do whatever I want to do. I love the independence and the freedom. Chavez is twice divorced and has been on her own since 1985. As a girl, she wanted to be married and have lots of kids, but I picked jerks, she said. She talks to her daughter Tracy every day and is close to several neighbors. She lives in the home she grew up in, inherited from her mother in 1991. Her only sibling, a brother, died a dozen years ago. In Chicago, Norrington is wondering whether to stay in her senior building or move to the suburbs after her car was vandalized this year. Since the pandemic, fear has almost paralyzed me from getting out as much as I would like, she said. She's a take charge person who has been deeply involved in her community. In 2016, Norrington started an organization for single black seniors in Chicago that sponsored speed dating events and monthly socials for several years. She volunteered with a local medical center doing outreach to seniors and brought health and wellness classes to her building. She organized cruises for friends and acquaintances to the Caribbean and Hawaii in 2022 and 2023. Now every morning, Norrington sends a spiritual text message to 40 people who often respond with messages of their own. It helps me to feel less alone, to feel a sense of inclusion, she said. This article was titled, Historic Numbers of Older Americans Are Now Living by Themselves, written by Judith Graham, The Washington Post, September 14, 2024. The next article is titled, Are Community Gardens Solving Food Deserts? Written by Isaiah Reynolds, Blavity, September 16, 2024. In 2023, nearly 34 million Americans did not have access to adequate food. That is roughly 10% of the country struggling to secure reliable food access. Due to the laundry list of urban planning policies, low-income communities are especially vulnerable to food insecurity and inaccessibility. When grocery stores shuttered or moved out, however, the community garden blossomed not only as a mitigative effort to food inaccessibility, but as an additional community space. Regarding food swamps, studies show a higher density of fast food restaurants is positively correlated with the percentage of black residents, while chain dollar store retailers saturate major black urban neighborhoods. Karina Polk, P-O-K-E, founder of Lettuce Live Community Garden Consultancy, witnessed firsthand this boom across southern cities like Memphis and Houston. It's not just about planting seeds and waiting for people to harvest them, she said, but actually engaging with the community on what is accessible and how to incorporate new produce into their diet. If you fail to engage the people that you're serving on the front end, it's impossible to get the people in that community to buy in, protect, and support it, Polk said. Often, community gardens around the country do fail. A pilot agrihood project in Macon County, Georgia, received a $500,000 grant to transform a previously underfunded and food-scarce community into one flourishing with locally led gardens. After 4 years, the project's only yield was two barren plots of land. Community gardens, as a whole, in the country, last less than 2.5 years. Everett Verner, V-E-R-N-E-R, executive director of the Macon-Bibb County Land Bank Authority, told Georgia Public Broadcasting. Lettuce Live has opened dozens of community gardens around the South, securing sponsorships from corporations, including United Healthcare, Home Depot, and Aetna. These gardens host workshops and test kitchens for students and nearby families. Over the years, Polk said, these gardens become a place just for the community to get together. During COVID, we were getting 25 to 30 kids every Saturday, and they were driving about 45 minutes from where they live, said Polk. Parents were telling me, this is the one place where the children can come and be safe. Studies show that community gardens could do more than just address food access issues. Public health benefits and environmental protections from flooding and heat are associated with the impact of community gardens. While gardens have made a sizable effort in addressing food access inequality, gardeners still consider it a first step in providing institutional and ensuring solutions to food scarcity. Each community has a different piece, You've got to tailor each garden for each community, Polk said. You will grow food, but as long as you're growing healthy humans, then the food is the icing on the cake. This article was titled, Are Community Gardens Solving Food Deserts? By Isaiah Reynolds, Blavity, September 16th, 2024. Next, an interesting article from Blavity titled, Climate Finance, Global Poor BIPOC Betrayed, written by Jean Yacoubou, Yacoubou, September 16th, 2024. The Pantanal, Pantanal, the world's largest tropical wetland sprawling across Brazil, Bolivia, and Paraguay, has been ravaged by intense wildfires since May 2024, becoming drier and making wildfires more likely. Meanwhile, plans to dredge a 500-mile waterway through the Pantanal for animal feed transport would endanger the livelihoods of 3 million indigenous people who live there. Meanwhile, in Africa, at least 20 countries all over the continent, including normally dry Sahara Desert nations, have experienced flash flooding and mudslides this year, killing thousands and displacing millions. What is climate finance? The sum total of all public and private funds for mitigation and adaptation to the extremes of the climate crisis is referred to as climate finance. Article 9 of the Paris Climate Accord, a quasi-legally binding agreement signed by 194 nations plus the European Union in 2015 to cap carbon emissions with the goal of keeping the average global temperature at or below 1.5 degrees centigrade above pre-industrial levels includes a reinstatement of a climate finance mandate. Developed countries shall provide financial resources to assist developing countries with respect to both climate change mitigation and adaptation. Earlier in the non-binding Copenhagen Agreement of 2009, the Global North pledged $30 billion between 2010 and 2012 to Global South countries for mitigation and adaptation activities, followed by $100 billion per year by 2020. The Paris Agreement extended the aid until 2025. The United Nations serves as the arbiter, A-R-B-I-T-E-R, of climate finance between the global north and south. Climate finance may take the form of concessional loans, characterized by longer repayment periods and lower interest rates, grants that don't have to be repaid, or donations. Green bonds and debt swaps are other mechanisms of climate finance. The UN suggested recently that at their next international meeting in November 2024, they should instigate a major step up in climate finance from billions to trillions. Why is climate finance important? Climate finance is important because it helps poor countries suffering the worst effects of human-caused climate change. It jumpstarts renewable energy development, sustainable transport, and other ways the Global South can avoid adopting fossil fuel infrastructure, which would set them on the same path of high carbon emissions that industrialized countries have taken. According to a 2024 report by the International Energy Agency, the African continent is home to roughly 20% of the human population, but 600 million 53% of people lack electricity, and over 1 billion cook over open fires, often using wood, charcoal, or animal waste, endangering human health and contributing to deforestation and carbon emissions. Yet, on an equatorial continent where the potential for solar power is great, only 2% of global clean energy investment occurs there. Instead, fossil fuel companies are building power plants run on coal or methane. Africa is also home to 40% of the world's mineral deposits needed for electric vehicles. The Democratic Republic of Congo, in fact, possesses 60% of global cobalt needed to manufacture lithium-ion batteries. As it stands, the global north is poised to use Africa for cheap mineral extraction, but keep manufacturing at home. For example, the European Union has set forth a policy that 40% of mineral processing should occur there. The UK has a similar strategy in the works. However, if mineral processing stayed in Africa, according to the non-profit Publish What We Pay, Africa's annual GDP would balloon by $24 billion and create 2.3 million jobs, injecting a major boost to its economy. Pacific Islands and Climate Finance. In an open letter to Mukhtar Babayev, MUKHTARBABAYEV, President Designate of the COP29 United Nations Climate Summit, which will take place in November 2024 in Baku, Azerbaijan, Joseph Zane Sikulu, ZaneSikulu, the Pacific Director for the nonprofit 350.org, expresses his frustration about the abject failure of climate finance. According to an April 2024 report, the costs of unmitigated climate change, $38 trillion by 2050, are already six times higher than those for implementing measures to curb it in order to stay below 2 degrees centigrade above pre-industrial temperatures. Study co-author Anders Leverman, ANDRSLEVERMANN, commented, "Staying on the path we are currently on will lead to catastrophic consequences. The temperature of the planet can only be stabilized if we stop burning oil, gas, and coal." Despite the alarms raised by scientists over the past 30 years, oil and gas production is at record levels in the U.S., and several fossil fuel companies are reneging on their pledges to invest in renewable energy. This article was titled, "Climate Finance, Global Poor BIPOC Betrayed," written by Jean Yakubu, Blavity, September 16, 2024. Next, an article from News One titled, "Jeffrey Page's Blues People, Set to Shine at Africa International Film Festival in Lagos, LAGOS," written by Shanique Yates, SHANIQUEYATES, October 10, 2024. Award-winning Broadway director and choreographer Jeffrey Page is taking his talents to Africa. Page has described the short film Blues People as a documentary showcasing Malian artists' vibrant cultural expressions. Thanks to recent news, the project will now be shown at the 13th Africa International Film Festival, ARIFF, in Lagos, Nigeria. According to a press release shared with Madame Noir, ARIFF, which first began in 2010, is a palace where cultural enthusiasts, filmmakers, and industry leaders from across the globe gather to celebrate and highlight the rich cultural narratives that make up the African and Black diasporic experience. For the last 13 years, the festival has also helped to bridge the gap between filmmakers across the diaspora, helping them to showcase their talents to a larger audience. "I am thrilled that Blues People has been selected for screening at the prestigious Africa International Film Festival, AFRIFF. This documentary short is a celebration of the deep cultural ties between the Malians and African Americans, who have historically used music and dance not only as forms of artistic expression, but also as powerful tools for resistance and healing, Page told Madame Noir. Inspired by Amiri Baraka's AMIRIBARAKA influential work, the film draws parallels between Mali's musical roots and the blues in America, highlighting how these art forms encapsulate the resilience and rich narratives of these communities amidst adversity. He added, "The excitement of having my work recognized by AFRIFF is immense, as it was initially crafted to share the stories of my travels and work in West Africa with supporters and grant makers. This selection underscores the universal resonance of our shared human experiences and the indomitable strength of the human spirit. No stranger to making the voyage to the motherland to tell authentic stories, Blues People is not the only project that will have Page return to Africa. Moreover, he partnered with I1 Digital Team to share another documentary endeavor, the GRIOT Project, G-R-I-O-T. As I continue my partnership with I1 Digital through Moving Legacy, I'm eager to delve deeper into how the dancing bodies of Black people across the diaspora carry stories and knowledge. Our bodies hold a form of intelligence just as potent as the spoken or written word, offering a unique lens through which to view our collective histories and futures," Page continued. "My aim is to connect the African diaspora through the powers of dance, showing that despite our differences, our similarities and shared experiences weave a rich tapestry of life that deserves to be celebrated and understood on a global scale." The documentary will follow Page through Francophone and Lusophone West Africa as he takes a tour to document and preserve endangered cultural traditions, while also capturing the buoyancy of Black and African cultural narratives. Set to live on News One, Page will also use this time to engage with local artists as he works to create a feature-length documentary film designed to elevate and amplify the voices of these communities on an international stage. As Page prepares to return to Africa, he aims to relish Blues People's latest milestone of making its way to ARIFF, taking place this year on November 3rd through November 9th. To support this project, please go to Kickstarter, Honoring West Africa, a documentary on endangered traditions. Join Jeffrey Page, former choreographer for Beyoncé, on a journey to document the endangered art and traditions of West Africa. This article was titled, "Jeffrey Page's Blues People Set to Shine at Africa International Film Festival in Lagos," written by Shanique Yates, News One, October 10th, 2024. Next, an article titled, "Take It from Naomi Osaka, O-S-A-K-A, Mental Health is as Important as Your Physical Health," written by Hanaya Philogene, H-A-N-I-Y-A-H, P-H-I-L-O-G-E-N-E, The GRIOT, October 10th, 2024. October 10th is World Mental Health Day, and Naomi Osaka is reminding us all to make mental health a priority. As Maybelline's first Brave Together ambassador, the tennis star will assist the cosmetics brand in its new campaign, working to make professional mental health resources readily available to those battling anxiety and depression. I think most people don't know that mental health is as important as your physical health. And in some ways, it might be more important, Osaka told People magazine, adding, "There's a little bit of negative connotation around anxiety and depression, sometimes. And I feel that it's important for people to know that these feelings, or just mental health in general, is completely normal. And we shouldn't be looking at people like they're weak or they can't discuss these feelings." For a brand as big as Maybelline to have created such an amazing program about it and just be willing to discuss it and bring it to the forefront is definitely very powerful, she added. Throughout her career, Osaka has publicly faced a number of vulnerable moments that have placed a spotlight on her mental health. In 2021, the tennis star withdrew from the French Open and Wimbledon tournaments to focus on her mental fitness. A year later, Osaka was brought to tears after being heckled by fans at the 2022 Indian Wells tennis competition. "I would never trivialize mental health or use the term lightly," the athlete wrote in a 2021 statement. "The truth is that I have suffered long bouts of depression since the U.S. Open in 2018, and I've had a really hard time coping with that. Today, the four-time Grand Slam champion feels fortunate to have been learning about mental health for quite a couple of years now, and is equipped with tools and resources to cope." While the star has incorporated various mental health care elements into her lifestyle, she admits that her mental health journey is ongoing, especially when it comes to social media. "I would say that I am not as involved in social media anymore, just because I began to feel like it was very negative, I guess, when people started knowing of me more," she explained. "So I sort of disconnected myself from that. I know that social media, in a way, is a little bit unavoidable, so I think that I'm still learning." In July 2023, Osaka also stepped into a new role as mom to her daughter, Shai, S-H-A-I, whom she shares with rapper Cordae, C-O-R-D-A-E. While motherhood has unlocked new joys and confidence within her, the 27-year-old admits it has also revealed new stresses. As a self-proclaimed overthinker, Osaka revealed that she's already planning to discuss mental health with her daughter. "I want Shay to feel like her feelings are valid, and nothing that she's going through should make her feel like she's isolated," she explained. "I think the biggest thing is that I want her to feel supported throughout her journey and throughout her feelings, because I think everyone goes through their own life, and we all just want to feel supported in that journey." As an advocate for mental health in sports and beyond, Osaka ultimately has learned that it's okay not to be okay. "It has become apparent to me that literally everyone either suffers from issues related to their mental health or knows someone who does," she wrote in her personal essay for Time magazine. "There can be moments for any of us where we are dealing with issues behind the scenes. Each of us as humans is going through something on some level." This article was titled, "Take It From Naomi Osaka, Mental Health is as Important as Your Physical Health," written by Hanaya Filonje, The Griot, October 10th, 2024. Next, an article from The Root titled, "Wait, Black Men Will Run Things at Vogue's Met Gala Next Year," written by Stephanie Holland, October 9th, 2024. In a surprising twist, the Vogue editor-in-chief, Anna Wintour, W-I-N-T-O-U-R, has tapped five of the most fashionable men in sports and entertainment to help her co-chair the 2025 Met Gala. According to Vogue, Coleman Domingo, Lewis Hamilton, A$AP Rocky, Pharrell Williams, and honorary chair LeBron James will help the fashion maven co-chair the big event. What makes these men such a fascinating choice is that not only do they have distinct styles, they're known for not conforming to gender norms. Inspired by Monica L. Miller's book, Slaves to Fashion, Black Dandyism and the Styling of Black Dysphoric Identity, the Costume Institute's Spring 2025 Metropolitan Museum of Art exhibit, Superfine, Tailoring Black Style, will feature garments, paintings, photographs, and more, all exploring the inedible style of black men in the context of dandyism from the 18th century through present day. Though an official dress code won't be announced until early 2025, we expect this exhibit to lead to a red carpet overflowing with black excellence. Before the 2025 Met Gala takes place May 5th at the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York City, let's take a quick look at the fashion personality of these five men. LeBron James. LeBron is more well known for his basketball heroics than his style. But as he has gotten older, the superstar has been more willing to take chances with his fashion. He likes to blend traditional looks with modern touches. You may see him in a classic suit with an interesting pin, pocket square, or even a designer bag. Coleman Domingo. Throughout the 2024 awards season, Coleman Domingo hit every red carpet with a look more unforgettable than the last. We never knew what to expect from his style, but we knew it would be amazing and we would be left gagging. Pharrell Williams. Pharrell Williams has never been called predictable, both as a rapper, producer, and a fashion designer. As the creative director of Louis Vuitton's menswear collection, he brings his unique outlook to the fashion house's new line. He also helps the culture evolve its style with his never-ending creativity in music and fashion. By the time people are copying him and trying to duplicate his vibe, Pharrell has already moved on to something new. Lewis Hamilton. Formula One legend Lewis Hamilton leans into the glamour of the sport with his fashion. He feels more like the next James Bond than the typical professional athlete. His previous Met Gala looks have shown that he brings the same courageous spirit as he displays on the racetrack to the red carpet. A$AP Rocky. A$AP Rocky is known for his pushing hip-hop boundaries. In fact, we don't think he even acknowledges that they exist. Rocky is not chasing trends or trying to set them. He just confidently wears what he and his family like, which makes for the best style. Other than LeBron, all these men will likely be in attendance at the 2025 Met Gala, which is currently scheduled for May 5th. If the Los Angeles Lakers make an improbable run to the playoffs, LeBron will be too busy to walk up the famous staircase. This article was titled, Wait, Black Men Will Run Things at Vogue's Met Gala Next Year, written by Stephanie Holland, The Root, October 9th, 2024. The next article is titled, North Carolina's Historically Black Colleges Are Mobilizing for November 5th, Tapping an Activist History. Written by Associated Press, The Griot, October 30th, 2024. Greensboro, North Carolina. Strewn across the coastal plains and backroads of North Carolina lie institutions that could be pivotal in the battleground state in Tuesday's elections. 10 historically black colleges and university steeped in a history of activism. Now, local student government associations and other organizations at these schools have mobilized in a full-on effort to galvanize nearly 40,000 student voting bloc. They're doing so as an HBCU graduate, Vice President Kamala Harris, is running for president. In the lead-up to Election Day on Tuesday, the North Carolina Black Alliance has been working with each HBCU and one predominantly black institution in the state to mobilize and transport students to the polls throughout the early voting season. The vote coming tour is a play on HBCU's homecoming season, a sacred tradition at the schools. The hope is to inform students of who and what is on the ballot from top to bottom and get students to vote early so they can avoid any voter ID or registration problems, said Gabrielle Martin, the Alliance's campus coordinator. The effort is nonpartisan, but there's no question that the presidential candidacy of Harris, an HBCU graduate herself from Howard University, is driving excitement. Having Harris at the Democrats' helm puts positive attention on HBCUs and gives them a seat at the table, said Justin Nixon, a senior and student government president at Johnson C. Smith University in Charlotte. We've always said what we're capable of, but now, especially, we can truly say that this is the clear representation of what an HBCU can produce and has produced. Still, students say their efforts is about civic engagement, not taking sides. It's really crucial, especially during an election like this, for us students to actually be taking the reins on something so important, said Kylie Rice, a senior and student government president at North Carolina Agricultural and Technical State University in Greensboro, the state's largest HBCU. We stand on the shoulders of giants, and we realize the civic footprint that was left for us. Now it's up to us to actually fulfill and keep that same momentum going forward. North Carolina's HBCU students have spearheaded civil rights movements for decades. For example, students at Bennett College in Greensboro, one of two all-female HBCUs in the country, protested a local movie theater in the late 1930s because it would edit black people out of films. In 1960, women from Bennett, known as Bennett Bells, were joined by North Carolina A&T students to protest a local lunch counter. I feel we're making our past Bells, our big sisters, proud and happy because they were behind so many movements, and now we're here to make history ourselves, said Linnell Johnson Huddleston, a junior at Bennett. In 2019, black communities in North Carolina were gerrymandered, notably in Greensboro, Charlotte, and other cities in a process that diluted their electoral power. North Carolina A&T students were impacted because the university was split in half and rallied against the maps in response. North Carolina is also saddled with voter ID court battles and now Hurricane Helene destruction that residents worried could hamper voting. We want to hype up early voting. So if there's a registration issue or an ID issue or a voting issue, period, the students will have time for a recourse so that their vote can still count, Martin said. The tour kicked off October 17th, North Carolina's first day of early voting at Shaw University. It ends at Fayetteville University on Friday. Local HBCUs have also hosted several other engagement events, including teacher-student voter information sessions at Bennett College, class wraps to explain the importance of voting at Elizabeth City State University, and various game nights with black fraternities and sororities. North Carolina is seemingly up for grabs since Republican Donald Trump's margin of victory here was just 74,481 votes in 2020, the tightest of any state he won over Democrat Joe Biden. That's a razor-thin margin, and North Carolina HBCUs alone are a significant voting bloc, Nixon said. So we play a large role in shaping the dialogue around politics and around issues within the black community. The Harris campaign is on an HBCU homecoming tour, which includes a stop at Shaw. The Trump campaign also plans to reach out to HBCU students directly, highlighting initiatives like the law he signed as president to establish permanent HBCU funding, said Janiyah Thomas, the Trump campaign's black media director. The push to muster young voters makes North Carolina HBCU students a force in the campaign's final days. We're Gen Z also, and for us, it's the first time we'll have a say, said Jasmine Rawls, 20, a Bennett sophomore who introduced Harris in Greensboro in September and will be voting for the first time. Having a say in what may be the most consequential election to date prompted Shelley Fogan, a senior and student government president at Bennett, to change her voter registration from her home state in Ohio to North Carolina. I voted absentee in Ohio last year for local election, but I had to ask myself for this election, where is my vote going to count the most? Fogan said, for me, it's North Carolina. We really should consider where our votes will have the most impact. Students want to know which candidates, locally and federally, will fight best for HBCU funding. These schools historically struggle financially, despite recent influxes in money. Bennett lost its accreditation in 2019 due to its financial standing. Without accreditation, colleges can't participate in federal programs like student aid. Bennett received its accreditation back in 2023. HBCUs have lower tuition costs, giving black students a greater opportunity to go to college. So the issue is important, said Aaliyah Crawford, a junior at Elizabeth City State University. Our funding is at stake, Crawford said. If that's lost, people have to figure out how to pay out of pocket to go here, and depending on your economic status, that basically chooses if you can go to college or not. Elizabeth City is a rural area that can get overlooked by political candidates. With fewer than 2,200 students, the school is the only local four-year college and contributes heavily to its growth. But students don't always feel considered, said Chasmere Chasen, a junior and student government official at the university. We really have to focus in on us and our student body because we bring so much financial backing for this city, Chasen said. Not everybody looks at us as part of the city. We have to make sure that we are advocating for ourselves, because if not us, then who? This sentiment ripples throughout the HBCU community nationwide. What students have to do now is use their vote, said Bennett student government president Suzanne Walsh. Our role, Walsh said, is to say, don't overlook us. This article was titled, North Carolina's Historically Black Colleges Are Mobilizing for November 5th, Tapping an Activist History, written by the Associated Press, October 30th, 2024.
That's all the time we have for the African American Hour. My name is Rosemarie Onkwe. Thanks for joining us.